This is Sean O'Brien for Arts Tuesday from Eastside Radio. I'm at the Ivan Doherty Gallery, where there's an exhibition called The Everlasting World of Martin Sharp, paintings from 1948 to today. And I'm going to be talking to Martin. Hello, Martin. How are you?
G'day, Sean. Nice to be on the show.
Now, let's go back to 1948, to the beginning.
Yeah.
And how you got involved in art, what your first attraction to art was, and how you were, as a young boy, led into art.
My mother loved it. She was interested, and her father was interested, and there's a collage in there, which I could show you there, and it starts off with my grandfather's sort of comic drawings as a boy, you know, and so a bit of a history in there. Unfortunately, the glue's coming through a few spots, but his drawings there, and then my mother's little drawings start coming in, and her collages, and then my work starts to come in there. So I sort of took it right back to the roots that I could find, you know, my grandfather's. I think I can even go a little step further than that. So one has the sort of, impulse, if you like, sort of growing. I guess I just grew up with a sense of it around, you know.
Mm.
Mm. This one here of the sailing ships called On a Sheet. I painted that. I was sick at the time, I think, and my mother let me paint on a sheet, you know. And it was a lovely, galleon sort of steaming through quite a rough sea there. And anyway, that was the first picture I ever had framed, you see, which is always very important for kids. They love having their works framed and shown. And but I was a bit cross because she did cut off. I had a portrait of Captain Eagle down the bottom there and his lieutenant Parrot or something like that. So they were sort of in those three-cornered hats with... but obviously they didn't fit in the frame. But so I'm very glad and my mother framed it. But of course I was cross she... cut off.
Well,
I consider it was a very interesting part of the picture.
Now, to actually frame some of these early works, your childhood works, I guess that almost in a way was a recognition that you were an artist.
Well, I think all children are artists. I really think they are, you know. And I saw once a fantastic book, my next-door neighbour, John Gregory Roberts, who's an eminent eye surgeon now, but he was a wonderful friend of my boyhood and still is a great friend. You know, they had a book, him and his family, I don't know where it had come from. It was an Indian, it was published in India at the time. It was a UNESCO book of a huge children's art exhibition. There was a universal sort of style across all the different countries. So it is a sort of, I think it is a language that children have. So they're all artists naturally, I think. And that's why, you know, children's art's so vital and interesting. And it's got, they all sort of initially paint, see the world the same way. So it's like a universal language, which I'm sure they could all understand each other in. You know, they do a house a certain way, figures certain ways, and very interesting. Anyway, it was a very memorable book, and I'd forgotten all about it until you... asked me about children's art. Thanks. And then in schooling, I remember Miss Nan Coulson was my first art teacher at Cranbrook in the preparatory school there. And I still have a picture from those days, which is of a dinosaurs and sort of, a big flying pterodactyls and things like that. So... you know, that universal world where children also paint and are fascinated with dinosaurs, you know. Anyway, this is a picture from those days, so I can go back a long, long way. I even have my very first drawing. I was going to put it in this exhibition, but maybe a later one, hopefully. But it's when I'm about 2 years and 4 months old, and my mother's writing to my father, who's... a doctor with a Spitfire squadron, Australian Spitfire squadron in England, and she's writing to him, and I apparently come up and take her pen and sort of draw on the page, you know. And she says, oh, you can see the child's just been with me. And I didn't know my father at the time, but I did this drawing, and she asked me what it was, and she records on the letter that it was an animal. I said it was an animal. Of what sort you wouldn't imagine. You could only guess. So I do a bit of anthropology on my own life.
Right. Mm. I notice here in the catalogue, After Still Life by Van Gogh, 1957. So even as early as that, you were attracted to Van Gogh and his art?
Well, I was given a prize by someone quite possibly from your family, Justin O'Brien, who was my art teacher and my art father, I call him. He's a dear, wonderful man. There used to be special art, which was a subject, which I was enrolled in, but I was a shy kid and I never asked anyone where it was. No one ever told me, and so I never went to special art for about a year. But eventually I did somehow find out where it was, or someone took me there. And as Justin said at the opening of one of my exhibitions at the Roslyn Oxley Gallery, he said, in 86, he said, once Martin found the art room, he never left, So he gave me a prize. He gave me a book on Van Gogh, and it's in the exhibition here, actually. I loved that book. I think it was my first prize ever sort of thing, except I got one for having the second biggest dog at a pet show. But he did ask me, say, well, why don't you do something out of the book? So I did a sort of rough copy of one of the still lives in the book, and that was my first a copy of Van Gogh, and up until, as you see, there's pictures in the exhibition, which I was really always inspired by him and working with his images. Yeah. If you read his wonderful letters, which he's as good a writer as he's a painter, he wrote how he wanted to create very simple images which people would get a direct sort of impulse from the sitter or the landscape, and that you didn't need to know about art to appreciate his pictures. And I think, he achieved this so well. And you could see how his pictures were painted. You could see every brushstroke. There was no artifice, if you like. You sort of look at a Renaissance picture, so you've got no idea how they possibly created such a magnificent thing. Yeah, but with his, you can see it all. It's all there. There's, it's a very visible what he does. And yet has this wonderful effect, such life in his pictures. Yeah.
And you've tried to maintain something of your childhood vision or the interest of children through your work, through your entire career, do you think? I mean, in terms of the use of some of the cartoon characters like Ginger Meggs and Boofhead.
Yeah,
and
yes.
Well, I mean, things that are of interest to children in a way.
Yes, yes. I learned to read with comics. It's interesting to read back into something you remember as a child and then to see it again and see, it's stayed the same but your perspective has changed. The Ginger Meggs was, I actually knew the widow of Jimmy Banks, Patricia, and I know her, their daughter, Sheena, and... But I loved the comic before knowing these people at all, they had beautiful colour comic books and things, and the Ginger Meggs one was, there was a frame in that where the storyline was the school concert is about to be on, and he's going to do If by Rudyard Kipling as his performance piece, and he's very keen on a girl called Minnie Peters who he's in love with, and... Eddie Coogan is his rival for her hand. Now, Eddie Coogan's out to sort of spoil Ginger's chances. And, oh, come over here, have a look through that hole in the wall, have a look at this. And he puts his, looks through, and they squirt ink all over his face. So he's, but he's unperturbed. He immediately ad-libs, and Ginger Meggs goes out and sings Sonny Boy and Mammy at the, as Al Jolson in blackface and sort of steals the show, and wins Minnie Peters. And it was a wonderful moment. But also I like where that moment where real characters and comic strip characters sort of meet. It's a sort of interesting interface. So I did a series of pictures on that sort of point where they meet. And the Boofhead's another one where the Boofhead sort of meets the thinker from Rodin's Thinker at the Art Gallery. All of these are from comic strip frames originally, so I developed the ideas from that. And Boofhead, of course, was my grandparents' famous favourite comic strip. My grandmother used to sort of cut them out of the Mirror newspaper and get a whole lot of the strips together and sort of bind them and stitch them together. So I had like a little comic book made up of Boofhead comics made by my grandmother, which was lovely. And so I, then he fell out of the papers, and I thought, I guess probably his author, R.B. Clarke, no one ever sort of kept him going. So, you know, Peter Kingston and myself have always tried to keep the memory of Buffett alive.
You came to kind of local prominence in a way while you were still a student and creating the comic strips. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
The Gas Slash was one that was at Thurunka. That was a more illustrated one about a drunken night at a student ball. But, you know, again, it was quite sort of anti-drink, I think you'd say.
But that ended up in a court case, didn't it?
Yeah, that ended up in a court case. And also this other one, which was just started, the word flashed round the arms. There was a gas turnip at Whale Beach Road, so we all piled into the minis and thrashed over, you know. So it was that sort of thing. The word got out, there's a party on, and so everyone crashed. And that's sort of what happens when they just beat up the parents and puke in the TV set and rape the girls. You know, it was a real rough sort of piece of writing, but it was moralistic, very extremely moralistic in its attitude, you know. It was against this sort of behaviour, but they were trying to sort of sell us the point that it was promoting that sort of behaviour, you know,
right.
Which it wasn't at all. Well, Gary Shedd, Ian Van Wieringen, and myself, John Firth Smith, and we were involved in sort of getting together a student newspaper at the art school, East Sydney Tech. And Gary was the editor, and he came up with the name The Arty Wild Oat, you see. So, and we interviewed Norman Lindsay and Colin Lansley and, you know, lots of terrific artists, and Robert Hughes, I think. And only had two issues, though, but through those two issues we actually met Richard Walsh, and was the editor on Issoir, and Richard Neville, who edited Thurunka. And you know, a meeting at some stage was called, and we all got together, and they decided to bring a sort of downtown version of the commemoration day issues of the student newspapers, you know, to downtown, and bring it out once a month outside the university, and that was Oz Magazine. And we all worked on that, you know.
At that time you were working within an Australia that was still very conservative, so where were your influences coming from in terms of the pop art, I guess, that you were were involved with?
Sort of from comics, you know, working. Because with Oz we had to sort of create, especially when it went offset, from letterpress to offset, we had terrific freedom of creating a page, and use that page, it would be printed just like that. So it was much simpler and more direct. And I think it was just sort of ad-libbing and working with collage a lot, and you know, sort of we did the advertisements in the style of the magazine, so the jokes kept going the way through the ads and everything. So there was a sort of, because it was only a very slim magazine, maybe 22 pages or something, 30 pages, but the ads had a satiric flavour to them, and there was quite a bit of using Batman and Robin and Ginger Meggs and all sorts of characters, and which you probably couldn't do these days.
Were you aware of the pop art movement coming out of America at the time?
Oh yeah, probably more from England, actually. I think, something in the air. You know, there's definitely something in the air.
Which even managed to get down into the air of Sydney.
That's right. Well, it might have started here. Who knows? No, it didn't. I don't think. I'm only joking. But it was right. You know, there's a very psychedelic picture there, which, you know, down the end there, which I knew nothing about, any psychedelics or marijuana, or I didn't even drink it in those times. So
that was that painting, that one? 17 but, Minutes to 4, 1965. Yeah. So you painted that while you were still here in Sydney?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
It's totally proto-psychedelia in a way,
yeah,
isn't it?
That's right, yeah. Sort of, collage was a big thing in those times and days. You know, I'm sure I was influenced, I mean... My mother used to get Queen magazine, had wonderful cartoons by John Glashan, an artist called John Glashan. And sure, he had quite an influence, and Gerald Scarfe, and probably just the graphic arts of the time. You know, one saw it in the magazines, at least they were coming through, you know.
So what drew you to London?
The Beatles and the Stones and the
So what, was it the music in a way that attracted you to?
Well, it was. It was I love pop music. I always have, and continued, you know, with my work with Tiny later on. But I mean, I always loved pop music. England was, you know, seemed to be a pretty sort of dull sort of place when I wasn't culturally getting anything coming from it. You know, there was there's one song came out of Liverpool by Laurie London, who was a 13-year-old boy who sang "He's Got the Whole World in His Hands," and that was a hit. But apart from that, there were no music coming out of England. That was exceptional, you know.
Right.
The rest of it's completely Elvis and, you know, the Bill Haley, and the pop charts were dominated, you know, by America. And then suddenly this, especially the Beatles, I think, came through with a sort of humour that was, they were funny as well. And their humour was very similar to ours, so one could, you know, got a terrific flavour from that and excitement, you know.
And then they visited here in 1964 to tour, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it was a big, big visit. Yeah, I went to see them. Unfortunately, Ringo was sick that night. But anyway, it was an amazing show. You couldn't hear a word. That was Sydney Stadium, which was an amazing venue.
Is that down in Rose Bay?
Down in Rushcutters Bay.
Rushcutters Bay.
I saw many great shows there, and it was a fantastic pop venue. I don't think it's ever been surpassed. It was our sort of Royal Albert Hall, you know, out of corrugated iron, built for Jack Johnson to fight in, you know.
Mm. So what year did you land in London?
I think an exhibition I had in my first exhibition in 1965 and got there about 66.
So did you fund the travel through the exhibition that you had here in 65?
Yes, that was quite a successful, I think my most successful exhibition anyway.
Tell us about the London that you found yourself in then.
I found a lot more sort of people who I felt a sort of sympathy for, who were sort of, you know, more art students, lots of art students perhaps, and musicians and people like that. And it was very wide and very welcoming. And I had a friend there, Bob Whitaker, who was a photographer who was working with the Beatles, actually. He got a job in Melbourne when they were touring, and he got a job through Brian Epstein working, being his photographer of their lives, you know. And we shared a studio together in Chelsea, and so it was very interesting there, yeah.
I'm interested in a part of your work from that period that it's not necessarily in this show, but some of the record cover designs that you were doing then for Cream, and some of the posters that you were doing, the Bob Dylan poster, etc. Much a part of the music scene, the happening music scene in London.
Pop musicians were, you know, the kings of the day, you know.
And how did you find yourself within that scene, being commissioned to do record covers for Cream?
Well, through Jenny Key, who's recently had a book launched of the period, you know, a terrific book of hers called A Big Life. Jenny was who I met out here at East Sydney Tech. We were friends from a few years back, you know, and she went to London before us. I mean, she had a connection with the Beatles and was, sort of headed over there because it was, England was exciting. It was rebirthing at the time, I think. She was working as a, you know, behind the bar at a club called the Speakeasy, or as a waitress or whatever, and, terrible name, Speakeasy. Anyway, it was a sort of top musicians club in the city, and, you know, people used to hang there, and she said, I should come down there. And anyway, I went down there and I saw a girl I knew called Charlotte Martin, and she was sitting with a couple of guys who I worked out were musicians. There were not many people there at the time, so I just joined them, and we got talking, and I'd written some lyrics for a song when I was in Ibiza or down that way, I worked out they were musicians. I said, I've just written a song, and one of them said, I've just written some music, and I said, so I wrote down the words. I mean, Serviette, and it was Eric Clapton, as it turned out. I didn't know at the time, and I didn't know who he was anyway, but he turned up a couple of weeks later with a record, and it was on the B-side, A Strange Brew on the A-side, and Tales of Brave Ulysses on the B-side, you know. So that's how it started, and And then, you know, Eric asked me to do a record cover. I mean, it was just natural, you know, that they'd achieved a certain sort of freedom that they could say, oh, we want, you know, because they all came from art schools, Eric and people like that. Well, we'll get our friends to do the artwork for us rather than get the design company from who worked for a record label, you know. So it was a different, the middleman was sort of eliminated in those years for a while, you know. I think that's what happened, yeah.
And so you did the covers of Disraeli Gears and Wheels of Fire, I think?
Yeah, that's right.
Which
yeah.
are, you know, two of the classic rock album covers.
Well, I think they're probably like, because they've got some classic rock inside them, you know. I don't think they'd be classic rock covers without the classic rock inside. But I did try to, you know, portray, you know, the music.
Thought the leaden winter would bring you down forever, but you rode upon a steamer to the violence of the sun. And you want to take her with you to the heartland of the winter. Fishes run laughing through your fingers, and you want to take her with you to the heartland of the winter.
While we're on the subject of music, I'd like to ask you about Tiny Tim, who became one of the primary influences in your work and your life.
Yeah,
when did you first encounter Tiny?
I used to listen to a lot of old music that it was getting re-released in vinyl at this from the past. Bing Crosby, Al Jolson, Ruth Etting, and Eric noticed it and he said, well, you must go and see this guy. You'd love him, Tiny Tim. And he was doing the Albert Hall, and I went to that, and it was completely amazed, you know, just amazed that someone knew the whole mastery of the whole language of popular song and used it as, you know, to express himself. And I thought it was amazing, you know. And
Tiny was already a superstar at that point to be able to play the Albert Hall.
Yes. Yeah. Well, he says he's already on the way down, he reckons. But later on he told me. And I thought this guy's going to be absolutely the pinnacle of American show business because of his great knowledge and his great ability to perform in the true spirit of the old songs, as well as his wonderful humour with song, you know, I Got You, Babe, when he played Sonny Ancher in that wonderful duet, you know. But singing A Brother Can You Spare a Dime, great songs like that, you know. He finished the night with a tribute to Noel Coward, you know, which was not many people would have known about Noel Coward, let alone being able to perform his songs with such fidelity. But he had the whole mastery of the language of popular song. It was sort of a point of time, and it fitted in with, you know, I was doing a lot of collage work with Andy Warhol's Marilyn, with the Vincent Sunflowers and things like that, mixing different things up. And so I was sympathetic to what Tiny was doing, and I thought, oh boy, I'd love to work with him. I could, you know, sort of do something for him. And as it turned out, I worked with him for 20 years, recording and filming and all sorts of stuff. It was a huge body of work. Yeah, he was a wonderful person. I mean, he's certainly one of the most amazing people I've ever met. I don't think I'll ever meet anyone more amazing than him. You know, he was so creative. And he was a fine man as well, and very... and he had a great religious Christian faith. You know, he had an amazing. He was, first thing was Jesus Christ. Second thing was romance, and third was show business. That was the order of preference for him. And he was very, in a most unusual sort of way. It wasn't any way you would think of as any way conventional, you know. And he could take the sort of slings and arrows of outrageous fortune very well. You know, he was tremendously resilient, you know, and you know, as we know, died on stage singing Tiptoes. I mean, he was a great champion, you know.
Come with me, come to the ball. Music and merriment call. Happy to be back and sing for you. I'll bring some melodies old and new. Everyone come to the ball. I am in love with you all. Each has a part of my heart.
I mean, your work is very much put with pop art in a way, but is there faith in your work as well?
Oh, yeah, definitely, yes, yes. There is. Well, I suppose pop art was a convenient sort of label which I sort of adopted, I suppose, in a way, quite willingly, as something to, some way to go. And because it was drawn so much from comics, it was probably sort of more postmodern in a strange way. But because of, especially the Luna Park fire was a huge, had a huge effect on me, and seeing its symbolism, that sort of great sort of, well, the juxtaposition of John Godson, who died in the fire, and these boys and the other boys who'd come from Mass, from Mary Magdalene, Rose Bay, and being on the Devil Station, Hull's Railways, you had this Luna Park and a full moon in the midst of the International Year of the Child, when there was a train strike running. You know, it had this huge sort of powerful symbolism of that night, you know, which was John Godson could represent the carpenter, you know, or the sort of conjunction of all those people who died in the fire, sort of, which I try to express in a picture here called Golgotha.
Can you just tell us a little bit more about that painting, Golgotha?
Well, you know, of course, Golgotha is the place of the skull where the crucifixion took place, and it's a sort of in the form of a cross, and it's got at the top, there's the top of the cross is John Godson, and then underneath his two little boys, and then flanked by the four Waverley College boys, whose Christian brothers come from Waverley to on their first night out as young 13-year-olds that night.
Yeah. So they're all the victims of the fire in the ghost train.
Yes, yeah. And somehow just one could fit it together. In a form which forms a crucifix, and I felt it was sort of like a crucifixion.
So this was in 1979, the fire.
Right,
but
right.
You had a long involvement with Luna Park at that point. You did a lot of the repainting in the early and designs in the early 70s, I think, which was my first introduction to your work as a child going in there when Luna Park had been repainted. And
73, repainted the face, which was about, things were getting ready for, the Opera House as a whole surge around the harbour. But, it had the best position in Sydney, a wonderful but then various people wanted, I think, that they couldn't get the lease then, and then it was a weekly tenancy, and there was a great deal of tension around that site, which exploded into that fire and the death.
I mean, Sydney being the city it is, I guess somewhere like Luna Park will have a cloud over it forever, because yeah. Sydney just does not tolerate fun like that in areas where there's a lot of money to be made, I guess.
Yes. You know, I feel it was sort of like a judgment on the city, you know, sort of not that the conflicts created this thing, but somehow God spoke through it, you know, in the name of the victims, you know. And, you know, then the sort of failure of justice to be able to deal with it, which, you know, brings a whole lot of things under the microscope, I think. You know.
Now, I'm interested in some of your more recent work, which appears to be dealing with Indigenous issues, for instance, the Aboriginal Cross of 2005, yeah. And also you've done a fantastic portrait of Gulpilil.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about your friendship with Gulpilil and also your interest in Indigenous issues in this country?
I'd seen David in Walkabout, and I saw the film. I was so impressed by sort of David, this sort of wonderful new beauty sort of on the screen, you know, sort of which, you know, one hadn't seen before, maybe not since Jeddah, you know, that wonderful movie before, you know, that beautiful woman, Aboriginal girl in it. And, you know, there's something so different about them and pure in a way, and I said, oh, I'd love to meet him. Anyway, you know, we saw each other over the years, every now and then. Not too often, but I remember him and Brett Whiteley having a great conversation at a party at my place one night. I don't know what it was about, but I'm sure I've got a record of it somewhere. And a few years ago, he was in town doing the Robert Tudawale Awards, you know, and I remember coming out of the hotel, he was seeing him at the hotel and coming out of there, and there was this preacher going past yelling out eternity in the streets, really. Really? I mean, it was this high-rise hotel on the streets, and he had a, you know, sort of billboard around his neck, and I thought, boy, this moment's been marked somehow. I wonder what I can do I'd like to do something for David, because I feel him, he's, you know, so brave coming down into this, from all the way up there into this world here of high rise, and it's very hard, tough for him, you know. And I thought, well, I'll do a portrait of him, put it in the Archibald, something like that, you know, that's what I did anyway. Mm. It's only when you sort of meet people that you really, I felt, you know, I was put in touch with the country perhaps for the first time or something, you know, there was a deep sort of connection there.
And has that flowed through into works like the Aboriginal Cross?
Yes.
What are you exploring in relation to works like that and Indigenous Australia and, I guess, your place here within Australia as well?
Well, I think, you know, you just got to make some images that are relevant and help and, you know, worthwhile. And I met Wanjak, of course, before, you know, who's the head of the Arts Board. And he was a wonderful man, Aboriginal Arts Board. And he said, you know, he'd... He'd translated the Bible into his his language up there, and that was, you know, lots of people, important people came from that area. And there was no conflict in, you know, the ability of them understanding the scriptures. It was just straight through. It was just like it was about spirit. They understood it absolutely. There was no sort of conflict there. It was only really, I think, in the more official sort of churches, perhaps there was sort of some difficulty, but... and I don't know, I thought it would work with the Aboriginal colours on the cross, you know, which... and it was sort of a bit inspired by Broadway Boogie Woogie by Mondrian. You know, sort of, that's sort of interesting to how many variations you can get on a cross and the different colours and try and express something with those colours. And the people like them very much, so...
But an object with all sorts of levels to it, I guess.
Yeah,
in a way.
And you know, when I went to I never knew Ted Kennedy, you know, Father Ted. But I went to his funeral, and I was absolutely move when they led the procession with one of those crosses, you know, which I'd given to the church there. I thought, boy, well, this is, you know, art's useful. That's the main important thing, I think, is that it's useful, you know. And it was useful, you know, and I was very touched by that, very touched. Yeah.
Do you think there is somewhere between the indigenous connection with the land, I guess, and Christianity that is useful?
I think so, yes. I went out recently to be best man at Rick Waite's wedding to Carol Ruff, which was, they invited me to be the best man. It was wonderful to go out there to Alice Springs. I'd never been there before, you know. And we went to Hermannsburg, and I was where of course Albert Namatjira had come from, and you know, the Ted Strelo, and great history of that mission out there, which has been fantastically great sort of meeting of, because they said, well, Jesus will save you, and Jesus did save them. You know, that's what they felt, that they were actually, because so many of the others were killed around the place and everything, but they had been saved by the Christianity and the mission. And I think, you know, I mean, they're the foundation of this country. I think if we don't build on that foundation, the whole thing's going to fall down anyway. I mean, I think it's the most important connection. It might be difficult, but they've been very patient. I think they're very loving people and very hospitable in their way. They've been extremely hospitable. You know, maybe in a way, you know, they mightn't be given so much choice, but they don't have to be as friendly and nice as they are, you know, and I think they've been, you know, it's the most important issue in this country. I mean, forget about all the other things. Iraq and all this rubbish seems so superficial compared to getting on with the Aboriginal people and establishing a real nation here, you know. The strength of the Aboriginal people, they can't be defeated. They'll just turn into rocks, you know, and wait their time. I mean, you can't disinherit them. It's impossible, you know.
And finally, I mean, you have been influenced by lots of different artists and artworks. How do you feel about contemporary Indigenous art?
It's amazing. I mean, I think what's happened is just the strength of art's been phenomenal. What's happened, you know, and it's so fresh and strong and new and got so many different facets to it, and most wonderful.
And Martin, congratulations on a fantastic retrospective.
Oh, thanks very much.
And good luck with your work as you continue it.
Thank you. Oh, thanks very much. I'll be back to work as soon as
we stop chatting.
I'll put a Christmas Carol in, you know, and a little figure of Tiny Tim from the Christmas Carol, and you know that I'm interested where, you know, the mythic figure of Charles Dickens's Tiny Tim becomes sort of the Tiny Tim of.
That's where Tiny, the name Tiny Tim, was originally from.
Yes,
Dickens'
it wasn't chosen,
Christmas Carol.
But from Dickens, you know, and his. Yeah.
Would you mind just perhaps reading the first page for us? Thanks.
Oh, sure. My dear reader, this little book is, and may it long remain, one of the really important books of the English speaking world. Everyone knows Scrooge and Marley and old Fezziwig and the ghost, and above all Tiny Tim. And Dickens did more than anyone else to make Christmas what it really is to thousands and thousands of people before the fame of the Carol criticism is silent. Thackeray called it a national benefit. We may today call it a world benefit, for its story and its Christian teaching have passed far beyond the land of its birth. Dickens wrote it with tears and laughter and tramped the London streets thinking of it, for he always lived with his characters and became for the time one with them. Coming out just before Christmas in 1843, it took the world by storm at once, and even now it is eagerly bought and read aloud in many homes at Christmastide. There's a mixture of wholehearted fun, pathos, and vivid description, and in its way it is a warning and a prophecy. But you will come back again and again to Marley's ghost and Fezziwig's party. I am yours sincerely, the editor. A Christmas Carol.